Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lighton. This is Open Source. The underside of police work is in the dock this George Floyd summer. Broadly, the charge is bringing the tools and the mindset of warfare into American cities. Excessive force with a racial tilt and impunity when it turns up on camera as open and obvious murder. Our conversation this hour is about reimagining police. And William Bratton, who would be the American police chief if we had one, will get it started. The big theme of the era, Chief Bratton will tell you, the theme of his own nearly 50-year career in Boston, New York, Los Angeles, and then New York again, has been reform and improvement. With bad lapses, yes, but he says we have safer cities in a safer country than we used to. James Forman thinks not. He's a public defender and now law professor out of a civil rights mindset and a family history, too. He's puzzling why Black America enlisted in the Clinton-era war on crime and didn't see mass incarceration coming. And then the historian of urban rebellion, Donna Murch at Rutgers, sees a friendly alignment of forces around Black Lives Matter this year. But first, Bill Bratton outlines his progress narrative.
Policing has been changing. It has been evolving. It has been reforming for the 50 years I've been associated with it. Where it is now is nowhere near where it was back in 1970 when it was not even a profession. It did not have any of the hallmarks of what you would think of as a profession. Didn't have an accepted body of knowledge, did not have an educated leadership or workforce. It was largely corrupt, brutal, racist. And that's not where American policing is today. If I have a regret or a frustration, as many of my contemporaries, many of my peers do in policing, is that the gains of the last 50 years are not being recognized. So much what is being asked for, what is being demanded, what is being protested for is already in place, has already been done to varying degrees in many departments around the country. But it is not recognized that there's almost nothing that is being called for in these demonstrations that I, for example, had not already put into place in Los Angeles when I was there. That's a shame because so much has been done.
I want to say with respect that that's still management talking. It's not what you hear on the street, even in Boston. It clarifies my picture of you as a very serious improver, reformer, an honest cop, but in a very tough game that looks more and more broken. Do you not see the a brokenness?
It's not broken. It's basically needs to be brought in for an overhaul and a tune-up and a significant overhaul. We have all the foundations necessary. We've got a lot of very good leadership in policing now. We have a very different makeup of policing, particularly in large cities in this country. The first woman didn't join the Boston Police Department until 1978. In the mid-early 70s, out of 2,800 police officers, only 55 were Black, and they were all assigned to the Soul Patrol.
We got to talk about the issues of today, starting with the use of force. In general, I think people feel the overassignment of police to non-police problems like George Floyd's $20 bill. But the culture of cops, the immunity of bad cops, killer cops, including Dan Pantaleo on your watch in New York City, the cop who strangled Eric Garner on camera, the warrior cops, the warrior mindset, and they seem to be immune from correction. We're talking about a system that does not want to be reformed. It doesn't even want to be interrogated.
We have an imperfect profession, like everything else in life is imperfect. We are constantly evolving. We have evolved for the better. Even the current crises that we're in will come out of this better for the crises, better for the experience, because it will accelerate change, and it will also cause a more significant introspection than we've had even over the last 50 years where we've had a lot of it. But you raised a point that I'd like to emphasize, that much of what police do today has been thrust upon them. Somebody trying to pass a counterfeit $20 bill. That's basically a crime. We respond to crime. Who creates crimes? The legislature. responding to public demand to do something about what is deemed to be a crime. So a lot of the criminalization over the last 40 years the police have been stuck dealing with, all of a sudden we're waking up and finding, geez, wouldn't this be better if we had psychologists? Wouldn't this be better if we had specially trained people to deal with the homeless? No, the good news is that we are now in discussions about this and the idea of what should the appropriate role of the police be in the 21st century, different than Sir Robert Peel in the 19th.
I want you to speak from the inside, Bill Breton, about change in police culture. Scott Thompson, the guy who turned the Camden police force around, said, "Culture eats policy for breakfast. It's the mood." In the pictures of the George Floyd murder, you could sort of feel it. There was a culture speaking there, three guys looking on as the brute, with a lot of complaints against him, does his evil killing. But behind that, a sense of what people call the warrior culture. We need warriors on the police force. The world is a place to be conquered, dominated, overcome. Interesting resonance also, I must say, with Donald Trump in Tulsa last weekend saying, we need warriors. He meant senators like Jim Imhoff or Tom Cotton, who agree with him on pretty much everything. Jim Imhoff, who doesn't believe the climate is warming, but he said, they're warriors. And he said about his people, they're warriors. It's a view of the world that's sort of waiting there to be taken possession of. Where does that change come from, and how real is it?
That's not a new issue. That back in the 80s, we call it the John Wayne syndrome, that meant my same as John Wayne with the Green Berets back in the 70s. To deal with the crime issues, the tremendous crime issues of the 80s, the worst decade for crime in American history, with 1990 being the worst year in the history of America for crime. The effort to bring people into the departments who could deal with what were the issues of the 80s. It was crime, a surging crime problem with gun violence.
It was a crack cocaine era too, right? I mean, that was the essence of it, wasn't it? Crack?
Well, but the culture at that time was basically supportive of, we need to basically have officers that can deal with this crime surge. The efforts in the 90s, and the effort actually was something I was involved in my early days back in the 70s. We had the Neighborhood Responsive Policing Program over in District 4, sponsored by 22 of the institutions in that area, the Symphony, Museum of Fine Arts, BU, Northeastern, that created the Boston Fenway Program, that came to the Boston Police and said, we need your assistance. This area is decaying so rapidly. We can't recruit students. We can't attract patrons. And so that's where I first began as a young sergeant, then lieutenant, running one of the first, what came to be called, community policing programs in the country. And people, even in the most crime-ridden areas, and I still had the original matrix sheets documenting the question, wanted to talk not so much about the serious crime, a lot of which they were not even aware of, they didn't read the papers, but about the prostitutes on the corner keeping them up all night, the abandoned cars, the graffiti. And that was where I first came to understand Sir Robert Peel's 9 principles.
Can I say the unarmed London body is the expression of that thinking, right?
Well, that was it. And also, if you go further into those 9 principles, the police are the public and the public are the police, meaning the police come from the public. And without public support, it cannot be effective.
I love the Robert Peel picture and the doctrine, but I can't separate it from the picture. We all had it in our children's books of that London officer. He's got a stick and a tall blue hat, but that's it. He's never to be confused with an invading army, which a lot of our police cars feel like nowadays, even in Boston.
Yeah, but they didn't have to deal with 350 million guns in America either, did they?
Yeah, more guns than people.
That's the major difference. Even today, police in England vote consistently, their unionized officers, not to arm themselves except with special teams to deal with, unfortunately, some of the gun violence, but the terrorism they have to deal with. In our country, it's a different culture totally, and that culture exploded in the 80s. Again, I came into the business in the 70s, and back at that time, we were still actually running into homemade guns because the availability of guns was very, very limited, particularly in American cities. And arrest to get a gun like that. But then in the 80s, it exploded with all the crazy guns that are out there now. So that we have 20 million people in this country. We estimate we have 350 million guns. And so the nature of violence here is very different than the nature of violence, say, in Great Britain, in England.
Let me change the tack a little bit, Bill. When you were leaving the New York Police Department, the commissioner's office, for the second time, de Blasio time, August 2016, after the Eric Garner disaster, Donald Trump was on the rise, a new kind of tough guy, he wanted us to think. And you said on television, I was fascinated, you said you were scared out of your wits by him. And you didn't get him at all. Where is this guy coming from? And you knew him somewhat, but he seemed such a fake. And in one of those exit interviews that you gave, I thought I heard the real Bill Bratton talking when you said, it's easy to be tough. It's a lot tougher to be soft, to reach out, listen to people with problems, maybe including Eric Garner. But as you spoke, it was a picture of the police work you're talking about. A million miles from the militarization and all the warrior talk in the air today, how would you bring that back? And could you have said that? Easier to be tough than to be soft. Could you have said that meeting with your union or in a precinct house in New York even then?
Sure. Dealing with the unions there, basically so that the city didn't fall apart after the murder of the two detectives following the Garner matter. We had our police unions extraordinarily angry at the mayor, de Blasio, and I spent a lot of my time dealing with both sides in that discussion. Something that you're not seeing, unfortunately, and a lot of others, of how much this profession has changed in terms of its makeup, its capabilities, the reforms it's been through, and the reforms it's capable of basically achieving going forward.
It's hard to think of a reform process in this police situation that's not going to include you, Bill Bratton. At the same time, I just wonder, in this atmosphere, can you tell people what I think you're saying, which is you never had it so good, the cops are better than ever, and you're just going to have to let us work through.
That's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying you never had it so good. America is, in 2020, at least so far, a much safer place for everybody than it was in 1990. Certainly African-Americans in particular can still point to issues that are of extraordinary concern to them. But again, that's what I'm talking about, that we're evolving, we're changing for the better by and large. We need to keep that in mind also. And in terms of, I'd like to thank myself in the sense of the department I joined in 1970 in Boston. God help us, what a mess that place was. The corruption issues, the racist issues. I look at the journey I've been on and the journey I continue to be on.
Coming up, Point of View is Everything. Public defender James Foreman is up next. This is Open Source. James Foreman Jr. got his name and a direction in life from a civil rights movement hero, starting back in the lunch counter sit-ins in the segregated South in the very early 1960s. Our guest, the son, got a Yale law degree and a Supreme Court clerkship with the late Sandra Day O'Connor, and then he plunged into the rough and tumble of the D.C. criminal courts as a public defender, lawyer for people who couldn't hire one. He won a Pulitzer Prize 2 years ago for his reflections on that work. It was titled Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America. What's wrong, I asked James Foreman, with the progress narrative as Bill Bratton delivers it? Better educated cops and more of them, more training and technology, and a steep, steady decline of murder rates, most famously in New York. What's wrong with that picture, I asked.
Well, what's wrong with it is that police abuse of Black citizens hasn't been reduced. Not every one of those initiatives that you said proposed to do that, but many of them did. Whether you're talking about diversifying police departments, or whether you're talking about community policing, or you're talking about implicit bias training, those are all things that in many respects may have been good ideas. But what has happened is that police departments have proven highly resistant to change. Good ideas have met a wall of opposition and intransigence and cultural resistance in police departments. So until that changes, you're not going to see reductions in police use of force that are sufficient. You're not going to see reductions in police murders or police killings of citizens. And that's the thing that has to change. It's always a thing that had to change. It was a thing that sparked Watts. And so that's been a theme of American history. And that's why people are so frustrated now, is that it feels like it's not changing.
Is it the last obstacle or always was the biggest obstacle?
It's both in a sense. I mean, looking back to the early part of the 20th century, I found that Black citizens have been complaining about police violence and police hostility, as well as complaining in some instances about police underperformance, that is to say, police not showing up. And those are two sides of the same coin. So Black citizens have basically been saying, we're not respected by law enforcement. When we need you, you don't come. And when you come, you're abusive. And neither of those things would be true if you valued our lives, if we were viewed as fully human and as fully citizen. That's the original problem. And it continues to be the problem right now. And it's one of the reasons why people are asking a more provocative set of questions today than they had been historically.
You have a different angle, especially as a public defender with a lot of experience making plea bargains and staring down the evidence, that sort of thing. From your point of view, James Roman, what drove this country into mass incarceration? And do you have a distinctive picture of a way out?
It's a big question. The first thing that we have to remember is that crime rose dramatically. In the 1960s and 1970s, we had a heroin epidemic that devastated Black communities in particular. We had a 300% increase in homicides in cities like Washington, D.C., 200% increase nationally. Then you have crack in the 80s and early 90s, and that also saw homicide rates double, triple, quadruple in some cities. And so there was an incredible fear. And then there were politicians who took advantage of that fear. And there were politicians who racialized that fear. So at the national level, Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, famously, then Bill Clinton tried to triangulate and take back some of that. And so he pushed his own kind of fear-based agenda so as not to lose more votes to Republicans. And then you have the media diving in with sensationalist accounts that didn't give context, that presented Black mothers as uncaring of their children, crack addicts who just wanted the next high, Black teenagers as thugs and as unrepentant and remorseless and predators. So you have all of these forces pushing together in the same direction. And one of the things that I research about is how in the Black community itself, there was a way in which we bought into some of these tropes and some of these narratives. And so you have Black elected officials who in many cities were pushing some of the same tough on crime policies that you see being pushed around the country, calling for the National Guard, calling for longer drug sentences, calling for mandatory minimums, calling for police in schools, calling for drug addicts and homeless to be treated like criminals.
Can I just say Black media was in on it too? Ebony Magazine, August 79, special issue. Black on Black crime, causes, consequences, cure. But politicians like Charles Rangel, Harlem's man in Congress, led the way. Maynard Jackson in Atlanta wanted to make the drug dealers' teeth rattle. I mean, this was pretty broad. And in Boston, it was a so-called 10-point coalition of Christian ministers who put themselves forward as brokers with the police. So it was pretty deep, rather amazingly so, given the, in hindsight, the bad reputation of the crime war, the Clinton crime war.
That's right. It was deep and it was broad. I think in some sense, you have to distinguish motivations.
Yeah, please.
So, you know, you have Richard Nixon, his chief of staff, Haldeman, famously said, look, we're going to go after crime as a way of pushing the race issue and going after Black people. It's not politically palatable to be explicitly racist anymore, so we're going to go after crime. So he was very self-conscious in his manipulation. Now you have people like Rangel and Maynard Jackson and others. And like I said, too many of them bought into this narrative. But I do think that for many of the Black politicians, the endorsement of some of this tough-on-crime warrior rhetoric came from some sense of caring and compassion for their communities and some sense of limited options, limited alternatives. So even though they ended up in the same place, I want to be careful about distinguishing different motivations.
Don't we see the problems today, though, as sort of the offspring of that moment?
Yes.
Mass incarceration especially.
Absolutely. I mean, 1,000%. So when we talk about policing and racist policing, it's not entirely of that moment. That has a longer historical trajectory, but it certainly includes that moment, because the moment of the 80s and 90s was a moment when many people had a let's take the gloves off kind of approach. This crime problem and the people that are selling drugs and using violence as a way of solving their disputes in the drug trade, they are so despicable. They are so reprehensible that anything you do to get them off the streets and out of our way is okay. So it did, in part, had its roots there. And I think one of the reasons why things are changing now is that you have a younger generation that doesn't remember that. They didn't grow up in that. They're not scarred and traumatized by those decades.
Where are we right now? Describe the moment and the possibilities.
You never know in the moment what your moment is going to be historically. You just don't know because you don't know what's to come. Having said that, and I don't know what it was like to be alive when the Montgomery bus boycott was happening in 1956 or 1960 and 61 when the sit-in movement was spreading throughout the South, or in 1963 when Bull Connor was sicking his dogs on children in Birmingham and the nation looked with horror and white people said, oh my God, I can't believe that this is happening. And black people said, this has been happening. I don't know what it was like to be alive then, but it might have felt like it feels now. That is to say, I feel extremely optimistic about the strength of the movement that I see going on in the streets. It's reaching every part of, I mean, little tiny nooks and crannies, the Yale Police Department. Who would have thought that the Yale Police Department would be coming under attack, right? From activists that are saying, wait a minute, how much is your budget? And should we be calling the police, sending somebody with a gun every time there's a party that's too loud? And that's just one tiny little example. It's not the most important. Mm. But the reason I raise this is it shows that it's not just the headlines. It's not just New York and LA and Chicago. It's small town police departments, university police departments all across the country, that citizens are rising up and saying, you know, I don't know that we should keep policing in this way.
Mm. James Forman, your word is reimagining police in this society. A better word probably than dismantling or abolishing or defunding necessarily. Describe what you have in mind. Where should this imagining begin? What are we looking for?
Yeah, the reason I like reimagining is that it focuses our attention not just on what we're taking away, but also what we're building and getting in return. And I think for Black communities, that's essential because, again, my research has shown and my own life experience has shown that Black communities care deeply about safety. People want to be free of fear. So when you just talk about defunding and dismantling, you do take away the fear of the police. That's true. But people are also worried about other things. They're worried about just crime in their neighborhoods. They're worried about burglaries. They're worried about break-ins. They're worried about robberies. They're worried about homicides and stray bullets and intended bullets. So I think reimagining focuses our attention on what we will construct as an alternative. And there, I think the key piece is, first off, to identify all of the things that police do right now that police don't need to do or that somebody with a gun doesn't need to do. So when we're talking about addicts on the street, when we're talking about homeless people, when we're talking about mentally ill people, when we're talking about noise disputes between neighbors, when we're talking about kids in school, that's a whole range of areas. Some cities, 40 to 50% of police calls go to one of the areas that I just mentioned. Well, what if instead of having an armed officer responding to those, we had somebody who was equipped to negotiate conflicts or to provide addiction services or provide access to a homeless shelter or provide mental health treatment? That's, in many instances, what communities want and communities need. So that reduces the police footprint. And then the other piece of this, the reimagining, is for the force that we have left, because I'm one that always believes that there is going to be some role for an armed officer of the state to provide protection to citizens. for however big that department is, there has to be adequate hiring practices, training practices, supervision practices, and accountability when people do wrong. It cannot be the case, as we see now, where 50, 60, 70, 80% of officers who go through a discipline process receive no discipline, or at most receive as their discipline, you have to go to a training class. And then if they're fired, they just get rehired by another neighboring police department. We cannot continue to avoid accountability for those worst actors, which is what happens right now.
James Foreman, you got your education in this system as a public defender in the criminal courts in Washington, D.C. We're learning about a warrior culture inside police departments on open display in the murder of George Floyd. Is there a warrior culture in the courtrooms among lawyers?
There often is. There's a sort of a good side and a bad side. Warrior policing is just bad, in my view. Police should be guardians, they should be custodians, they should be caretakers, but they should not be warriors. In the courtroom, there is a place for that. That is to say, in particular, I think on the defense side, when you're representing one individual and they have all of the resources of the state stacked against them, there's a crime scene, who goes? The police go. They take evidence. They talk to witnesses. They get the first crack. We don't get to send an investigator to the crime scene right after it's occurred. So there may be witnesses that say my client wasn't there and they may be lost forever. So the prosecution has that. They have more money. They have judges on the bench. Many of them are former prosecutors. The defendant is by himself or by herself. And I think in that instance, you want and you deserve a warrior.
You're the warrior, in other words.
You should be the warrior. The problem is, I believe, that the prosecutor shouldn't be. See, the prosecutor to me is like the police officer. They represent the state, which means they're supposed to take everybody's interest in mind, including the person who's being charged. They're supposed to care about them too, because if you're charged, you are still a resident or citizen of that state. So I think it's actually an instance where we should have one side operating as warriors, but the other side operating as guardians.
James Foreman, you observed somewhere that if every black church, and a lot of white churches too, adopted people coming out of prison, you could absorb so many people in need of a new stability. Why not organize that?
We have a little bit under a million people who come out of some correctional institution a year, and that's counting jails where there's a lot of cycling of people. So, you know, people will go in for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month, come back out. And we know that when you come out of prison or jail, the extraordinary hardships you face, you may be given a bus ticket, you may be dumped on a corner. The only ID that you have in your pocket is your Department of Corrections ID, which very few people accept, no money. Again, same underlying problems that you had going in, low education, mental health, addiction, you've still got. So it's a recipe for personal failure and societal disaster. And a million people a year sounds like an extraordinary number. But the point that I was trying to make is that we have 300,000 religious institutions, churches, synagogues, mosques, temples in the country. And if each of them adopted three people coming back into their community and said, listen, we'll help you find housing, a job, we'll take you to get that ID that you need. You know, it's $30, $40, $50, $60. If you don't have any money, then $30 is $1 million. You don't have it. So we'll help you do all of that. We'll help you get resituated. I don't think this should just be the role of volunteers. I think government should be investing in this. But in the meantime, while we advocate for that, there's a lot that we can do individually in our faith communities.
The test is going to be sustaining and leveraging this rather incredible feeling that something's got to be done.
Yes.
How does the country do it?
What activists and advocates have to do in this moment is they have to build the institutions that are going to sustain the energy. That's what happened in the 1960s. My father was one of the early employees of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and my mother dropped out of college to join that organization, which is how they ended up meeting. And SNCC grew out of a series of unaffiliated sit-ins that were going on. College students around the South began to sit in. Probably the most famous one was at the Woolworths in Greensboro, North Carolina.
Right.
Those were protests. But those protests only sustained a movement when an organizational structure was built around them. And that was the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And what activists need to remember, the young people need to remember, is don't let older people co-opt your movement. Don't become an arm of an established organization. When those students first came together, some suggested that they should become an arm of SCLC, which is Martin Luther King's organization. And Ella Baker, famous organizer whose name deserves more attention than it's gotten in our historical memory, she said, no. Don't join SCLC, because if you join the ministers, you'll just become a youth wing and they'll run the movement. You need to have your own institution and your own organization that is young people led and student led. And I think young people today have to do the same thing. So that's the movement. But the rest of us, we have a role to play as well. Mm. Every institution, every employer, every neighborhood group should get together and should create a space for a dialogue within that organization that is structured around a couple of fundamental questions. First, in light of everything that has happened and this renewed attention to racism in American society and police brutality specifically, what is it that we can do more to respond that we haven't done yet? And the second question is, what are we doing now that we should stop doing? I think if people come together around those questions, that very rich and provocative ideas will come forward, because this is a problem that touches every single institution in America. So we all have an obligation to respond.
James Former Jr., we thank you for your questions, your experience, and your spirit.
Thank you. It was a joy.
Coming up, why the movement summer of 2020 feels so familiar and so different. This is Open Source. Look for patterns in the history we remember, and you can see shocking events that ignited movements and others that didn't. The police murder of George Floyd stirred the world on the first news a month ago, and the waves are still rising. At Rutgers University in New Jersey, Donna Murch is a prolific historian of race and rebellion in our times. I asked Donna Murch this week to set the movement feeling this summer of 2020 into the framework of her studies.
So the first thing I would say is just the scale of the urban rebellions that we're seeing, that they are all over the country, that they've been going on now for over 3 weeks, that they're in over 400 cities. So a lot of people have compared them to the urban rebellions that start, really the most famous is Watts, which is the largest civil disturbance in history in the United States up until that point. But I would actually go back in time a little bit to Birmingham in 1963 and to the Harlem Rebellion in 1964. So these are mass civil disturbances. And in the 1960s, they were called race riots. That's really quite inaccurate, because the United States has a long history of racial pogroms. So the discussion that we've seen in the past week with Donald Trump choosing to give a talk in Tulsa, which is home to one of the worst racial pogroms in our history, those were also called race riots. But what we saw in the 1960s were hundreds of thousands of people going out onto the street and engaging in civil unrest and property destruction. So the 60s is, I think, a natural period to look to for what we're seeing today. An important point about that is that the discourse that was used in the 1960s by the mainstream media was often that the riots were destructive and resulted in urban decay. But the truth is, the riots were actually quite successful in wringing concessions from the federal government. It's then that you see the founding of the Department of Housing and Urban Development and millions of dollars that are poured into American cities. So they were able in 1968 to make claims on the state and to really win major concessions. One of the things that makes this moment very different is that we have Trump in the White House. We have a far right-wing Republican Party. And so it's very difficult right now to wring concessions from the federal government. The federal government is being absent, whether it's in terms of COVID planning or its response to mass unrest.
It also engages the Democratic Party in a complex way. Joe Biden, the Democratic candidate, also in a certain way, the father of the crime bill in the Clinton administrations. How is this playing field different?
I think that what we really have to really honor and recognize as the origin of this protest is the scale of political grassroots organizing that's been taking place in the United States for most immediately, I would really date it back to 2009 with the killing of Oscar Grant in Oakland, California by Johannes Messerling, who was a transit cop. This was covered in social media. And there was an enormous campaign from many, many different sectors of the Black community. And so you see this focus on state violence and police killings as a way to build a new movement that at the time, in like this early 2010, 2011, we were still calling it the anti-state sanctioned violence movement. But with the coining of the hashtag Black Lives Matter in 2012 and the response to both the killing of Trayvon Martin and the acquittal of George Zimmerman is really when we see the takeoff, followed by Ferguson in 2014. So I mention that because it's hard to talk about electoral politics without understanding that it's really grassroots organizing around Black youth. And I see this moment as the fruition of those organizing campaigns. In terms of electoral politics, I mean, I can't imagine a worse Democratic candidate for this moment than Joe Biden. But because of Donald Trump, because of his explicit racism, we're no longer talking about dog whistles. When he quoted the mayor of Miami about when the looting starts, the shooting starts, which was a direct call for violence against both nonviolent civil disobedient protests and other kinds of protests. Trump is so explicitly racist, right-wing, and also just disturbed and unpredictable that even a conservative Democrat like Joe Biden is getting much more support than he would normally. That said, it's a painful reality. Joe Biden supported and helped introduce Clinton's crime bill, and he was quoted as saying in the early 90s that when we look back in history, the Democratic Party will look like J. Edgar Hoover, and the Republican Party will look like Abby Hoffman.
Remind us of all the things that were in that crime bill. We associate it with three strikes, you're out, longer sentences for everything, and the result, the main result, mass incarceration. How do you see it now?
It's not the beginning of mass incarceration, but that period during the Clinton presidency is the single biggest period of incarceration that's at state and federal level. And the crime bill contained many things. It had these mandatory minimums. One of the most shocking elements in it is that it allowed for the death penalty for drug offenses, for high-level drug offenses, so-called drug trafficking kingpins. And one of the ironies about this is that several years ago, Trump, in discussing the opioid crisis and attributing it to MS-13, which is completely erroneous, he was calling for the death penalty for these alleged drug traffickers. The irony is, of course, Trump didn't know that that power had already been granted through the Clinton crime bill. So this was an incredibly important moment, and it was also accompanied by the reorganization and really elimination of federal welfare as we know it. So the Clinton period in the 90s was this essential moment for expanding federal crime control, funding projects like Weed and Seed, supporting mandatory minimums, an enormous expansion in the drug war. So almost every different aspect of this system of punishment was expanded under the Clinton administration. So in that sense, I think we're in a moment where people are talking about anyone but Trump, and it's absolutely understandable. But I do think it's important to look at the history. I think that social movements and grassroots organizing has the power to shift electoral politics. So I put my trust not in Joe Biden, but in the many different groups of activists in the Movement for Black Lives, BYP 100, the Dream Defenders, a variety of different organizing groups to really fight for an end to mass incarceration.
Before we let go of Joe Biden, though, A, can the movements deal with the irony inherent in voting for Joe Biden, but also assume that Donald Trump taunts Biden somehow for his role in the anti-crime era. What is Biden to say?
I am not sure what he will say. You know, it's possible he will make a mea culpa. I think one precedent that we could look at was Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton's response to Black Lives Matter, calling them out in 2016. And Bill Clinton, especially, who was kind of in this aspect, I think, trying to shoulder some of the burden of that presidential campaign, he argued that the real call for the expansion of incarceration came from inside Black communities themselves, right, that this was a time of crisis. And at the time, I thought this was deeply unprincipled because it was the unwillingness to simply say we were wrong. And instead, they were reviving the very narratives that were used to justify this period, including the idea of the super predator. So they repudiated the language, but they kept the ideas the same, that this was a problem generated within the Black community and that they were only, in some ways, helping. And I hope that Joe Biden will not do that and that he will take inspiration from this moment to understand that the United States has shifted. The thing I find most exciting about the urban rebellions is that we're seeing their broad geographic reach, including very small cities like the one that I'm from that now has 50,000 people also have had their own rebellions, and the multiracial makeup.
Yes.
So I really do think that we are seeing a crumbling consensus around law and order. Trump is almost like a man walking, how could I describe this? He's like a man walking in a different time, and he doesn't realize the moment that he's living in. He has repeatedly tried to revive the discourses of the silent majority, of law and order, the language of both Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan. And he hasn't been able to successfully mobilize the rest of his country, only his base, which is roughly 30% of the American electorate right now. So that has also been really heartening to me to see that over time, through with grassroots organizing and also urban rebellions. So that's very important. Like, I think that these urban rebellions, even though they're always talked about as being destructive, they have actually had a really profound influence in changing the way that we understand law and order, the way we understand policing. And even, I mean, we are now having a discussion about defunding the police. Mm. And I actually think that would not have happened without not only nonviolent civil disobedience, but the real expression of a sense of crisis.
We're seeing the 70s, 80s, 90s in a different perspective nowadays, and even in this hour on the radio. First came heroin, terribly destructive, 80s crack. Why the crack epidemic? Where did the crack come from? Why couldn't somebody stop that supply rather than invade neighborhoods, put a lot of people in jail? If it were, you know, bad water or something, it would have been cleaned up.
Yes. Well, the interesting thing about cocaine in the United States is that up through 1979, cocaine is an incredibly expensive illegal commodity that only a very small number of people could afford. But starting in 1979, which is also the date of the Nicaraguan Revolution, where you have a socialist government that takes over, it deposes the dictator, Somoza, and not only Somoza, but all of his elite military guard and kind of military leadership essentially are given visas to come live in the United States. Mm. And you can't understand the crack crisis in the United States without looking at the anti-communist foreign policy that was going on abroad under Ronald Reagan, in which a lot of the right-wing governments were involved in drug trafficking. And there's a reason for this. You know, drug economies that are off the books can raise incredible amounts of money. So you actually have a coup in Bolivia in 1980 that's called the Bolivian Cocaine Coup. We have Ronald Reagan's invasion of Grenada. You have the support of all of these right-wing governments in Latin America. And as a result of this, the government was really, at best, was looking the other way while these illegal drug networks were being established. This is why you see the onslaught of cocaine into the United States. And what that means is that that is a market like any other market. And when the supply increases, the price went down. And it's in the early 80s that you begin to see the mass marketing of cocaine into low-income neighborhoods. So that really is the genesis of crack. At the same time, you have this expansion in the war on drugs. The justification is crack, the crack epidemic. And we have a whole closet of monsters of crack babies, of crack addicted mothers that are used to mobilize these enormous resources to really target some of the most vulnerable people. And I would argue that these are really fictions, that they are used in order to frame it. So those cultural rationales really matter, because when Donald Trump talks about when there's looting, there will be shooting, and the constant calling of protesters thugs. He's going directly back to that same retinue, essentially, of propaganda, which is thinking of people as monsters, and the only solution to monsters is to eliminate them or to incarcerate them.
Hmm. Donna, we're also an empire in retreat all over the world, ever since Vietnam, really. It's not just that we haven't won a war. Our military is obviously inappropriate to whatever problems we're attacking. What's coming home in all this debate over a militarized police system in so many cities?
I mean, the United States is in precipitous economic and imperial decline. That predates Donald Trump, and I think to some extent Donald Trump is actually a symptom of that decline. In order to understand Trump's election, I think we really do have to go back to the 2003 second Iraq war and the ways in which the enormous expenditures and also the lack of oversight, you know, in hearing what's going on with the PPP process, I literally, it's like having deja vu from what happened with the bidding for contracts in Iraq and Halliburton. In terms of the militarization of policing, this goes back very far, as early as the 1960s with the establishment of the first SWAT team in Los Angeles that's deployed first against the Black Panther Party. In the first SWAT team, every single member was a former veteran, and they were able to use military surplus. This was vastly expanded under George H.W. Bush and then under Bill Clinton. So this is a story that predates Trump, but I think that there's a literal connection of the militarization of police being given military hardware, but also the training that has gone along with that and the conceptualization of the police as a military force.
Yeah.
And I think one of our big challenges in the United States right now is that under Donald Trump, in some ways, because of his level of conflict with members of the military and also the intelligence services, in some ways, they have been posed as the adults in the room versus Donald Trump. But I actually think we need to have a reckoning, not only with police violence, but on our really failed imperial adventures.
And
that is going to be essential if we also have the money and the resources, given the trillions of dollars of largely unregulated money that the Trump administration has given out to major corporations. We are heading for very, very frightening austerity. And so I do see these questions about not only defunding the police, but expanding social welfare. In order to find the money to do this, we're having a time of reckoning. And I think that we have to revisit the question of our enormous imperial infrastructure abroad and our endless wars.
At the core, we keep learning is racism with an old history and deep roots. And we know the price of it in economic disadvantage, in COVID vulnerability, in so many ways. But we're also close, it seems to me, you can see it from here, a new reconciliation. How could we get to a breakthrough?
I'm a Black Panther historian, and they were real pioneers of a vision of coalition politics called rainbow politics. It was later embraced by Jesse Jackson and popularized in a series of different local and national campaigns. But the idea is that what brings people together are a set of shared principles and goals. So for the Black Panther Party, stopping police, stopping the war in Vietnam, both war on Black communities at home and then war in Southeast Asia and other parts of the world. And I think that my vision for today is similar to what we're seeing in these urban rebellions. They're truly multiracial, and they're speaking to, again, understanding racism not only as a set of ideas, of bigoted ideas, prejudice and disdain, but actually a structural feature to our economy and to our society. And that to me is really striking, and it's really moving to me to see that as a multiracial project.
Donna Murch, thank you so much for your learning, for your patience with my questions, for your encouragement.
Thank you so much, Christopher. It was a pleasure.
Thanks also to James Forman and Bill Bratton. Please think of supporting Open Source. The best way is by becoming a monthly subscriber on Patreon. You'll get extras like Adam Coleman's ongoing series about reading in a time of social distance. This week, the writer Stephanie Rentz on the Baroque horrors of Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian. Find it at patreon.com/radioopensource. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies and Adam Coleman. George Hicks is our legendary engineer. Mary McGrath is the good cop from RB. I'm Christopher Leiden. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source.
Hub
and Spoke. Audio Collective.